Hello, my name is Kayla Verhoeven, and today is Thursday, May the 28th of 2026. We'll start off with part one of the pantograph, In Touch with Graphic Arts. Half Hazard Press engages public with posters and apparel. 2 hours ago, local business, Bloomington. Inside the Half Hazard Press shop, art is something to engage with, not just look at. The posters lining the walls may have started as illustrations for touring musicians, local businesses, or the shop's own releases, but co-owner Christopher Gray wants visitors to see them up close. And more than that, he wants them to feel the difference. I always tell people, our art is the kind of art that you don't have to be fragile with, Gray said. We invite people to come in and touch the prints. That physical quality is central to the Bloomington-based design, print, and graphics art studio at 400 South Madison Street in downtown Bloomington, where posters, apparel, and other creations are still made through a hands-on process of separated color layers, transparent films, coated screens, ink, and pressure. On the second floor, the individual layers of artwork are printed onto the transparencies before being burned onto mesh screens coated with photosensitive emulsion. Each color in a poster gets its own film, its own screen, and its own pass. The result is something different from a digital print, Gray said, something many people do not fully understand until they stand in the shop and see it for themselves. For over a decade, Half Hazard Press has built a reputation far beyond Bloomington, designing and printing concert posters, apparel, and other merchandise for artists like Billy Strings, The Dave Matthews Band, Eric Church, Primus, Daniel Donato, and Dead & Company. The shop has left its fingerprints locally, from beer labels for White Oak Brewing and coffee packaging for Serious Coffee Roasters, to skate shop graphics for Crib to Crib Skateboarding Company. It has also created the logo for Waiting Room Records and collaborated with other Bloomington Normal and Central Illinois businesses. This is part of the balance Half Hazard Press is trying to make more visible. Being a nationally recognized business rooted in a local do-it-yourself culture. Gray said the company has always been locally based, even as much as its work has been on a touring and national scale. This has led to moments where people walk into the shop and realize the posters already hanging at home were made just a few minutes away. It's still surprising to me. Once in a while, when somebody will kind of walk in and be like, "Oh, I have a bunch of those posters. I didn't know you guys were even here in town," Gray said. Half Hazard Press began as a side project in 2013 before becoming official in 2014. Gray and co-owner Joel Hunter met while working contract jobs on a creative services team at State Farm. Gray had a background in printmaking and screen printing, while Hunter studied graphic design and focused on illustration. The partnership became a trade of skills. While Gray taught Hunter more about how illustrations could become physical prints, Hunter helped Gray strengthen his illustrative approach. Hunter said screen printing forced him to work with limited colors, budget considerations, and the technical realities of how shading and line work translate through the medium. Over time, those restrictions became part of the appeal. When it comes to illustration, it gives you a lot of limitations because of the medium, Hunter said. Personally, that's something I've learned to really enjoy. Those limitations also shaped the look of Half Hazard Press. Gray said many of the shop's concepts come from a quote-unquote rooted Midwestern perspective, coming through thrift store finds, local history, old buildings, nature, folklore, or the kind of visual references gathered from simply walking around town. As for new collaborations and projects, Hunter said each one often starts with a few basic questions. Where is the show? What does the place mean to the people there? What does the band sound like? What has already been done for that artist? And what idea can meet the band and the buyer and the artist in the middle? You want to be happy with the work, Hunter said. You want to make sure that the people paying you to do it and then the people that are going to buy it or are going to be stoked to put it on their wall. That fan-first approach is especially important in posters, Gray said. When the shop designs a poster or a piece of merch, he thinks about the person walking into a venue looking for something that adds to the night rather than making them feel like an afterthought. We want the piece of artwork that they see as they're entering for the night to be the thing that charges them more, Gray said. It gets them more hyped. The shop's current home, where it has operated since about 2021, is its fourth space in 12 years. Gray described the three-floor, more than a century-old building as a culmination of lessons learned from every previous location. The space has been built out gradually as part print shop, part showroom, part workspace, part hangout, and part venue. For Hunter, the building fits the business in a way the previous space did not. I feel like this one officially feels like home, Hunter said. I like that it's a little beat up, a little grungy, and we can go all out on just putting stuff in every inch of the wall that we want to. Waylon Mellick, who has worked there a little under a year and has been training on the apparel side, Mellick, who is from El Paso and moved to Bloomington a couple of years ago, said they came to Haphazard Press after spending time around Crib to Crib Skateboarding Company and ended up helping out. I've always kind of been a creative person, Mellick said. I can't stand working in an office. I don't mind hard work, but I can't sit at a desk all day. Being able to make stuff with my hands in a cool place like this is just my ideal situation. What stood out after they started working there, Mellick said, was how much of the shop's world is made in-house. We're not going out and buying a bunch of stuff, Mellick said. We try to make with what we have. That do-it-yourself spirit extends to the building itself, where staff members have built out parts of the space, including a deck and a stage, using what they had available. Nathan Christie, who handles shipping, receiving, and much of the customer service side of the business, said he would like to see more people simply come in, sit down, and spend time in the shop. It's a nice creative space, Christie said. I wish that we actually had more foot traffic. People to actually come in and just sit and chill and hang out and enjoy the space. He has also seen how often local customers do not realize where their online orders are even coming from. Some Bloomington Normal customers order from Haphazard Press without knowing they could drive to the shop in minutes. Recently, at a local Christmas market, one couple saw a Dave Matthews Band poster and realized that they already had Haphazard Press artwork at home, Christie said. We have your artwork on our wall. We thought you were in Chicago, Christie recalled them saying. Gray said that kind of response is part of why the shop is making a renewed push to become a more public face. Haphazard Press is preparing to bring back their Hallowed Hall curated art shows, potentially including performances in its own space and at other local venues. Gray said the shop is also interested in offering screen printing classes, hosted comedy shows and event nights, and reopening an internship program to connect with area schools. The goal is not just to sell posters, but to make the shop useful to the broader creative community. It's always meant to be kind of a workspace, semi-functional, also a hang space, and a collaborative space, Gray said. Our doors, basically, are always open in a creative sense. That local focus is also showing up in the shop's Route 66-related work. Gray said Haphazard Press is working on local releases with Duncan Manor, designs with Dobin's Pizza, and its commemorative pieces tied to the centennial, including a shirt and a poster. After years of deadlines, touring clients, and stacked production schedules, Gray said the shop has learned to move more quickly and at a time that the work feels like playing a dozen games of chess at once. Now, the pressure looks different. Artificial intelligence has created new challenges for illustrators, Gray said, as clients can use prompts to create graphics and AI models are trained on years of artists' work posted online. But the shop's response is to lean harder into what AI cannot replicate. Intent, connection, and the feeling of a real object made by people. For Hunter, success is not only about bigger clients or more orders. In some ways, he said, Haphazard Press has already achieved the thing it set out to do. We started from essentially the bottom and cut our teeth into it and grew enough reputation to get to do the kind of work that I never thought we'd end up doing, Hunter said. The dream is it continues, and we get to keep our guys on and keep that dream alive. You can visit halfhazardpress.com for more information about the shop. Once again, you can visit halfhazardpress.com for more information about the shop. Moving on now to some economic news. Rates hammer home buyers. Inflation, bond market driving mortgage costs. By Fresent Goebel, Ezra Fizer, and Michael McKenzie, Bloomberg News, 2 hours ago. Economy. Najima Robertson, a lifelong renter, spent the past 2 years searching around Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for a home she could afford, getting outbid nearly 30 times along the way. The ordeal had the 42-year-old daycare business owner, quote-unquote, in tears for weeks, before she finally found a 5-bedroom fixer-upper for $340,000. It has an overgrown backyard and dated carpet, but more troubling is the mortgage rate she's facing as the June closing approaches, leaving her on the fence about whether to even go through with it. It's beyond stressful, she said. Her situation reflects a larger reality. The era of ultra-cheap mortgages that reshaped American housing for a generation shows no signs of coming back. In fact, every single from the $31 trillion Treasury market indicates that rates may rise even more. Since the oil price shock from President Donald Trump's Iran war unleashed the biggest jump in inflation since 2023, bond prices have tumbled, pushing yields on some U.S. government debt to the highest level in nearly 2 decades. The rate on 10-year treasuries, which sets the floor for mortgages, has climbed to around 4.6%, with traders saying that 5% is within reach. That has pushed the average 30-year home loan to over 6.5%. Across Wall Street, traders expect inflation, the main driver of rising borrowing costs, to worsen as the energy price increases filter through the economy. Investors have abandoned bets that the Federal Reserve will resume cutting interest rates, with many now wagering it will instead start raising them as soon as late this year. If you're looking for relief on a 30-year conventional mortgage rate, you're not going to get it anytime soon, said Kevin Flanagan, head of the investment strategy at WisdomTree. The bond market's movements are exerting a major drag on a real estate industry that for decades benefited from a steady drop in interest rates. That crested when the Fed dropped rates to near zero after COVID hit in 2020, creating a bonanza for those who seized on it to buy homes or slash their bills by refinancing. As a result, roughly half of the American homeowners have mortgages at 4% or less, according to data from the Intercontinental Exchange Company. The twin legacy of that period, a flood of low-rate mortgages and higher inflation, is now vexing buyers like Roberson. With many locked into loans well below market rates, Americans have been saying to put longer than ever before, or 8.6 years on average, according to data from ATTOM. That's contributing to a dearth of inventory, just as borrowing costs climb. Many have shifted to the sidelines to wait it out. Others are discovering that the American dream of home ownership painfully is out of reach. Decisions made during the period of ultra-low interest rates coming out of the pandemic are still shaping behavior, said Torsten Slock, the chief economist at Apollo Global Management, citing the reticence of the low-rate mortgages to move. The shift to higher rates has fundamentally changed the economics. Home sales had been expected to pick up during the spring selling season. There are tentative signs of improvement in the market, with pending sales rising for 3 straight months and new listings increasing. But the demand is stuck at historically low levels, with the pace of closings last month more than 20% below what they were in April 2019, before the pandemic hit. Nick Barta, a regional manager at Security First Financial, a mortgage company in Inglewood, Colorado, said the spike in rates has a chilling effect. In February, He was seeing more business than he had in 4 years as customers refinanced or considered buying again. Then it slowed virtually overnight. All you hear about is gas prices and higher interest rates, said Barta, who has worked in the mortgage industry for 38 years. It freaks people out. The trend has been both a drag on the broader economy and a political liability for Trump. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent last year expressed confidence that the bond yields would come down as the administration reduced spending, lowered energy prices, and unleashed a period of non-inflationary growth. But Trump's tax cuts, tariffs, and war in Iran have had the opposite effect by adding to the federal debt and rekindling inflation. At the same time, the rise in gas prices is taking a toll on consumer confidence, which has tumbled to a low record. An April Gallup poll found that inflation, housing, and energy prices are the three biggest financial worries for United States households. Early this year, Trump directed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to start buying $200 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities in an effort to nudge mortgage costs lower. Federal Housing Finance Agency Director William Poult, who oversees the firms, said that the Trump administration is monitoring mortgage rates and remains focused on supporting the housing markets. FHFA and the administration are actively evaluating a range of tools and policy options to improve affordability and expand access to home ownership for American families, he said. Trump has also repeatedly criticized the Fed for not lowering rates. A half percentage point drop in mortgage costs would make homeownership possible for roughly 3 million more Americans, according to the National Association of Realtors. Yet even with Trump ally Kevin Warsh taking over the central bank on Friday, traders are betting that the Fed is done cutting and is virtually certain to start raising rates by early next year. As a result, the market rates already ticking up. That's leaving a generation of would-be home buyers locked out of the market, said Sarah Wolf, a senior economist at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. They want the same things as the generation before them, she said, and the bar to entry is getting higher and higher, with assistance from Katie O'Donnell. Moving on now to some city news. City orders data center moratorium. Bloomington, Drew Zimmerman, 2 hours ago. Bloomington. The city of Bloomington has established a temporary moratorium on a data center that exceeds 5 megawatts of capacity until its staff is able to develop its own regulations for these facilities. On Monday, the city council approved a 6-month pause that could be subject to an extension. The decision comes almost a week after the Normal Town Council voted on its own moratorium on data centers, which would run through November the 30th. There currently are no official plans to build large-scale data centers in the Twin Cities, Bloomington, and Normal, officials have said. Bloomington City Manager Jeff Juergens said the moratorium ordinance includes a requirement for the Bloomington Planning Commission to hold a minimum of 2 public forums. These sessions would include presentations from experts in the data center industry and other parties involved in the public discourse around the projects. This will be a deliberative process where it is very transparent, and we will have outreach to the public, Juergens said. Last year, the Bloomington City Council set foundational zoning requirements for data centers, which had been treated as warehouses under city code. The council also set new definitions for data centers that distinguish hyperscale campus-type facilities from smaller enterprise-level ones. Projects would be allowed within the city's manufacturing districts, but a special use permit would be required if the site is adjacent to a residential district boundary. Additional requirements included site plan review, entrance design, buffering, and screening and minimum parking requirements. However, community feedback from 2 public forums in May reflected a desire for additional standards that would address environmental impacts noise, and infrastructure demand. McLean County's latest data center regulations, which will be subject to a Zoning Board of Appeals hearing next week, call for a data center developers to identify roadway or infrastructure improvements necessary for a new facility. During the public comment portion of Monday's meeting, members of the public expressed gratitude for the decision to impose a moratorium while these standards are reviewed. Bloomington resident Adrian Hahn said a lot of people think hyperscale data center is being considered at the Central Illinois Regional Airport, which has been denied by airport and city staff. But if a data center were considered in that area, it could compromise the air quality and the visual aesthetic. Other issues would be light pollution in surrounding neighborhoods and migratory birds flying away, Hahn said. There's insufficient water resources, massive energy consumption, and e-waste. Moving on to courts and crime, jury rejects attempted murder. Man convicted on lesser charges in a shooting in ISU, by Caitlin Klepek. Bloomington. A man from Chicago accused of a shooting in April of 2025 at the Illinois State University Bone Student Center has been found not guilty of attempted murder following a McLean County jury trial. Amir D. Thomas, 20 years old, appeared last week before Judge William Yoder for a jury trial, charged with attempted first-degree murder, a Class X felony, aggravated battery discharging a firearm, a Class X felony, and aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon without a valid firearm owner's identification card, a Class 4 felony. After a two-day trial, Thomas was found not guilty of attempted murder, but the 12-person jury agreed he was guilty of the other two charges. Thomas was arrested in June of 2025 for the April 2025 shooting on campus. He turned himself in upon learning a warrant had been issued for his arrest. He has remained in custody ever since his detention hearing. Evidence. During trial, the prosecution, represented by Assistant State's Attorney Ashley Scarborough, presented evidence that Thomas had pulled out a gun and shot another young man after an altercation between two groups of friends. The two groups were known to be having ongoing conflicts with each other prior to the shooting, but on April the 27th, video evidence showed Thomas fighting with the victim before pulling out his gun and firing shots, the prosecution said. The victim was struck by two close-range shots, with the first shot hitting him in the back and the second hitting him in the leg, Scarborough said. The victim suffered non-life-threatening injuries with a laceration to his left kidney, Scarborough said. At the scene, police found two spent shell casings and an unspent .40 caliber round, the prosecution said. Police said that they were able to identify Thomas as the shooter in the video, based on his previous contact with law enforcement. At the time of the shooting, Thomas had been enrolled at Southern Illinois University, his defense attorney said at his initial appearance. The defense, represented by attorney Stephanie Wong at trial, argued that the defendant had not tried to kill the victim, having fired shots that were non-fatal, though fired at close range. Defense attorneys also spoke to the fact that the defendant turned himself in for the incident. After over 4 hours of deliberations, the jury ultimately agreed that although Thomas fired shots and unlawfully possessed a gun during the incident, he had not intended to end the victim's life. McLean County State's Attorney Erica Reynolds denied a request for comment concerning the case. Thomas is scheduled for a sentence hearing on July 6th at 2:30 p.m. Continuing on with more crime in courts, we have a spotlight. Arlington Heights man detained in McLean County on grooming charges, by Caitlin Klepek, 19 hours ago. Bloomington. A man from Arlington Heights has been detained in McLean County, accused of grooming a teenager. Juan Adeem, 59, appeared before Judge Don Knapp Tuesday afternoon for his initial appearance, facing one Class 4 felony count of grooming. Assistant State's Attorney David Fitt filed a petition to detain the defendant, arguing he posed a danger that could not be mitigated by any conditions of release. According to the probable cause statement, Adeem went to a fast food restaurant in McLean on December 23rd of 2025 and left his phone number for a teenage boy working as a cashier. Employees told police the encounter was quote-unquote odd and creepy, Fitt said. The restaurant manager called the defendant, posing as a teenage boy. When the manager mentioned the boy's age to Adeem, he apologized and said he didn't realize the boy was that young. However, Adeem texted the manager's number, thinking it was the boy later that night, asking the boys to send photos of his genitalia, according to the probable cause statement. Adeem texted, quote-unquote, sorry for being disrespectful shortly after, and messaged the number the next day to wish the boy a Merry Christmas, Fitt said. On December 29th, the boy's mother reported that her son was being harassed by an older man. On January the 5th, she contacted police again to report the man had continued to contact the manager's phone number, thinking it was her son. The restaurant employees told police the man had said his name was John, and they were able to find his Facebook profile, leading police to identifying him as Adeem. Fitt said Adeem had gone by several aliases and had a criminal history indicative of thwarting law enforcement, including destroying evidence. In arguing for his release, Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace described the means by which Adeem was charged with a quote-unquote vigilante investigation, noting that the restaurant workers had contacted the defendant, who at first said he didn't realize the boy's age. Instead of detention, Wallace suggested home confinement and a no-contact order with anyone under the age of 18. But the judge agreed with Fitt, noting Adeem's criminal history and seven aliases. Knapp ordered Adeem to be detained in McLean County with no contact with anyone under the age of 18, specifically noting the teenager named as a victim in the case. Adeem was scheduled for an arraignment at 10 a.m. on June the 26th. How time flies. 3 hours ago, 100 years ago, on this date, in 1926, negotiations, which have been underway for weeks, ended yesterday when the Illinois Power and Light Corporation signed a 10-year lease for the building of George Brandon Sons at the southeast corner of Main and Monroe Streets, and for three upper floors of the Lincoln H. Weldon Building adjoining to the south. 75 years ago on this date, in 1951, high winds, both over the weekend, knocked down six trees, tore off branches, put phones and lights out of commission, and blew over one smokestack, a survey revealed today. 50 years ago, on this date in 1976, the county will determine what the Fairview site is worth, and the Normal City Council will decide whether it can afford it. That was the general agreement between the McLean County Board's Property Committee and Metro Manager David Anderson, Normal Mayor Richard Godfrey, and Parks and Recreation. 25 years ago on this date in 2001, Navy Ensign Irving J. Dave Davenport took over as officer of the deck on the USS Oklahoma at 0745 on December the 5th, 1941. It was a Sunday morning, and the ship was moored at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. 10 minutes into his watch, the 1940 Navy Academy graduate heard explosions in the distance. As the plane pointed skyward, Davenport saw the rising sun, insignia of the Japanese Empire on each wing. Davenport sounded the first alarm as the first explosion rocked the battleship. The crew raced to man guns, but the firing pins had been removed and ammunition stored below deck while the ship was scrubbed in preparation for an admiral's inspection the next morning. The only guns we could have fired at the torpedo planes were our pistols, said Davenport, 83, of Bloomington, who recalls the attack as if it happened 6 days ago, not 60 years ago. We were helpless. Thank you for listening today with me, friends. I hope you have a great day. And until next time, we'll read part two of the pantograph. Have a wonderful afternoon.